From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, May 21st. I'm John Myers from KQED. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, looks a little sleep-deprived.
I'm blowing up.
Over there.
What? My cell.
Oh.
People hitting me up.
Oh, that's good. This is a different Anthony than I've heard before. Your cultural linguistics are impressive.
Well, you know, I figure if it's good enough for Dan Walters this week, it's good enough for me.
I've never seen Dan Walters use the term dude in a column.
But we may or may not talk about
that. Oh, we'll talk about that. Okay. We'll talk about that.
That's a tease.
We got a lot to talk about. There's a ton. It seems like it's going on right now.
Jeez, it's like all at once.
We're less than 3 weeks from the election. We got a budget debate that's starting to heat up at the Capitol with the governor's revised budget just coming in. And let's go back to the election. Let's talk about this new poll that everybody's talking about. Let's talk about the race that everybody's talking about. And then we'll kind of mention the other races.
The 19th Assembly District primary?
Yeah, of course. No. I know that race well. Race for governor, Republicans, Meg Whitman, Steve Poizner. Everybody knows it by now. 9 points. Nine points.
Which, incidentally, I believe wasn't nine the legislature's approval rating in the last PPIC poll?
The last one. They went up in this one, I think, to like 13 or
Ooh.
Something. They're doing much better.
Don't call it a comeback.
So, yeah. So, Whitman leads Poizner 38-29 in the PPIC poll released on Wednesday night. 31% undecided, which Mark Baldessari, the pollster, I think, talked to all of us. And I think he's right. I think that is really one of those really fascinating things. That's a lot of people undecided for
3 weeks out.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think of how much money we would say has been spent. You know, upwards of $100 million.
Well, yes, the candidates
combined.
The candidates themselves have spent $92 million thus far. That's just the two candidates.
68 from Whitman, to be fair. Most of it from one candidate.
Only 24 from Poizner.
Yeah.
Hence, that's the world we live in.
You know, so you've probably read some of this if you're listening to a politics podcast, but just for those who were in a cave or something
for
48 hours. Yeah. So in those numbers, so about a third of the voters in the Republican primary undecided. Whitman, and then we've got to compare this to March. So, I mean, that's really the number. If you look at PPIC's polling, you know, and you try to take apples to apples of one group's polling, she was up 50 points in March, and now she's up 9. She's dropped about 17 points in most of the little subgroups. People who aren't college graduates, she dropped by 29.
The little subgroups
of voters. People whose annual household income is at least 80 grand, she dropped 28 points.
All right. The race is closing.
The race is close. Right. Okay. So you first.
Me first.
What do you make of this?
I guess it's still the big question of – you know, if you listen to the Whitman people, they would have you believe that this is the high point for the Steve Poizner campaign, that the race is opening back up. If you listen to the Poizner people, they say, hey, look, we told you so. The race is closing, and it's going to continue on this trend line over the next 3 weeks until Poizner comes back. You know, they don't want to quite compare themselves to Gray Davis in 1998, but they like that narrative. And so
they both have gray hair, and they both like blue shirts.
Whoa.
That's the only thing I came up with.
Wow.
Other than that, I don't know.
You've thought this through.
The blue shirt thing I thought about a while ago.
Yes. I'm so flabbergasted by that connection. I'm now going back to my my conspiracy theory well, and I'm going to see what I come up with.
All right. Well, what's interesting here, I mean, you're right. Both candidates and their campaigns are really spinning this hard as to, you know, don't worry, this poll looks fine for us. A couple of things. First of all, every poll is a snapshot in time, so we don't know where the race is on any given day from this poll. This poll was a 7-day poll.
Yes.
They came out of the field. They were done wrapping this up on Sunday.
It's already a week old. Right.
Exactly. So we know that the campaigns are doing nightly tracking polls showing, you know, every little fluctuation or hiccup or burp of the public, how they feel about the race. What's interesting to me, though, is, you know, when you look at the numbers, Whitman at 38, Poizner at 29. I don't know this academically. I'm just guessing here, just my gut instinct. 38% to me has got to be her base support, because think about the money and the beating she has taken in television ads about Goldman Sachs, about her voting record, about her investments, about, I don't know, the money she has, everything else. You would think the people who are saying they're going to vote for her now are really going to vote for her. In other words, I mean, can't her? I don't think her support could drop if it was just, if my gut instinct is that's her base level. Now, the question is, what is Poizner's 29%? Is that an upward trend or is that his ceiling, as the Whitman campaign would make it?
Right.
But suffice it to say, using my little, playing my scenario out one more time, if that's truly her base at 38, and you've got 31% undecided, this race is still hers to lose.
Poizner
would have to win 2-1. He'd have to go 2-1 and winning the undecideds to come back and win this race. And there's 20 days, 19 days left. That's still an uphill battle.
Right. I mean, I think this poll shows a couple of things. Number one, I think the Poizner people are right when they say Whitman's support in the March survey, she was up by 50 points and she had, 61%?
Yeah, 61.
That there was some softness in her support, and it was vulnerable to some of these attacks, the Goldman Sachs stuff, and in Poizner's defense, I mean, not only has Whitman taken a beating, but she spent $68 million of her own money defending herself. So,
I don't know that it's all been defending herself.
Well, or putting her image out there,
she's been beating him over the head pretty hard too.
Now, what Poizner has succeeded in doing is prying loose some of those people from Whitman, at least. Buying himself a second chance, right?
Or allowing them into the undecided column.
Yeah, by prying them off away from Whitman into the undecided column, they're saying, okay, look, I'm going to reevaluate my assessment of Whitman, but Poizner hasn't closed the deal yet either. I mean, they're not ready to go to Poizner, and I think that's the million-dollar question. I mean, it's not just...
A million.
$100 million question, right? That was my 1973 figure adjusted for inflation.
Just for inflation.
That's the question, is whether Poizner can convince these voters to ultimately support him against Whitman. One of the things the Whitman folks point to in this survey is they look at the general election matchup. And they say, hey, look, Whitman's going to be a stronger candidate against Jerry Brown.
Yeah,
and so
let's talk about those numbers for a minute, because that's a good place to insert that. So in the hypothetical November matchup, Whitman was in March. She was ahead of Brown by about 5 points. Now Brown's ahead of her by 5 points, but she's still closer to Brown than Poizner is.
Right.
I, of course, didn't bring that particular document.
I believe that it was a 7-point spread. I checked this, and I believe the Brown Poizner spread was 15. But I will check that while you're talking and pretend I'm listening to you.
But the point is, they're right. November matchups. Oh, look. Oh, yes, right. See, I did bring this in here. Right. Okay, so Brown is 42, Whitman 37. If it was Poizner, it would be Brown 45, Poizner 32, a 13% gap.
Right.
And so what's interesting is, that clearly I see, their point they're making there is fine. What's just fascinating, too, though, is that when you break down those numbers even more, this was something I was looking at in writing something for this last night, for Wednesday night, is that when you look at Republican voters aren't convinced that Steve Poizner should be the nominee.
Right.
Which is a weird kind of dichotomy here, it seems like to me. They're maybe more leery of Meg Whitman now if they're really just asked about who do you want, Whitman or Poizner. But when you look at that November matchup, she gets more Republicans to vote for her than Poizner does in a November race. Poizner actually loses some Republicans, it appears, to Jerry Brown.
Well,
in small percentage numbers. And I guess my point here is that you would think if Poizner was the absolute favorite of the diehard Republicans, he would be higher in that November matchup of Republicans voting for him. You know what I'm saying?
Well, no, because I think the reason for that is probably Poizner's making an appeal to the base because of the primary. But some of those primary voters are more moderates. And if you accept the belief, that Poizner is the candidate to the right and that Whitman is the more moderate candidate, I think it would stand to reason that some people would be comfortable with Meg Whitman as the nominee.
And look at the
but maybe not Steve Poizner.
And look at independents. She draws more independents in a theoretical matchup against Brown than Poizner does, right?
Right. And so ultimately, I mean, look, that's a hypothetical matchup. I mean, I would imagine if you look at 2002, the Bill Simon numbers against Gray Davis, I'm sure that they probably showed a similar thing, that Richard Reardon would have been a stronger candidate against Gray Davis. But that doesn't mean that he can win a Republican primary, number one. And number two, the ultimate race between Davis and Simon was a heck of a lot closer in the end than it looked like, I'm sure, than it looked like in May of 2002.
You know, a couple of other things, too. I mean, this really does show the power of a few things. It shows the power of negative campaign
ads. The power of love.
No, that's a Huey Lewis song.
Ugh,
I could remember that on the fly, too. That's what's really impressive about that.
Can that be our outro music?
Yeah, we'll get the rights for that. That'll cost a little money for the podcast.
Take it out of my salary.
It shows the power of negative campaigning, negative television ads that everybody says they hate, but they work. I mean, you know, that clearly has had a big influence, you've got to believe, on Whitman's numbers.
Well, that's the vast majority of what we've seen. I mean, the memorable ads, at least in this campaign, have been the negative ones. And I think, you know, some of the grousing in the press this week, I think Dan Moraine this morning in the Sacramento Bee writes
Thursday
about
morning.
It. Oh, what? Right. What did I say?
this morning.
Silly me. Wink, wink.
Friday mornings when people will be listening to this. Yeah, right. But right. Those ads. And you got to wonder, too, it's a little early for a postmortem on the race. But just for a moment, given
that rarely stops me, right?
Right. And this is a podcast, and we'll go a few more minutes. We'll talk about the budget, of course. But given that Whitman had the Goldman Sachs question out there and that she had these things and her campaign knew all of this, you know, about her investments, about the congressional investigation in 2002, they knew all of this.
Yeah.
Might they have wanted to deal with that earlier in the campaign and get it out there and try to just own it before anything else would happen? I mean, they didn't know the national story was coming. The national story was a tremendous bit of good luck for the Poizner campaign because it attached Goldman Sachs, even though the two stories didn't have anything to do with each other. It attached the name Goldman Sachs and brought up the issue.
Right.
But it just seems like that, you know, you're a campaign person. You're a pro. You know your candidate's got this stuff. Do you want to get it out there before your opponent gets it out there? I don't know.
I mean, she enjoyed a big lead in the polls for a long time. And on the flip side of that, while this stuff was not out there, she enjoyed a huge lead and began to build an aura of inevitability and invincibility around her, which may be protecting her somewhat in the polls now. So
it might have actually been an era.
I think I've demonstrated in this podcast all the reasons why I am not a campaign strategist.
Nor I. And one other thing, just quickly on the Poizner thing, is there anything else Poizner can do at this point? Because, I mean, hasn't he thrown everything at her? And as an example to me, this week where Poizner tried to make some allegations about her and porn on the internet. You know, and that to me, sorry, Team Poizner, felt a little thin. In which case, if that's all you got left to go after her with, I mean, now isn't this really just up to the voters? No, and now the voters have to decide whether all of these concerns about her merit changing their mind again.
Yeah, I mean, I think the larger point is right. I think Poizner's got to close. He's got to give voters a reason to definitively vote for him.
In other words, not so much more anti, but pro him.
Well, or really cast a vote against Meg Whitman. I mean, so if that 38% is solid and still with her and her base, as you surmise, and I don't think that's unreasonable, he's going to have to find a way to pry off whatever it is, another 23% of those 31% that are undecided, right?
Yeah. I mean, really, 2-1. If you do the math,
still an uphill climb, but we'll see. 3 weeks left.
Yeah, exactly. And then just really quickly, you know, Whitman, we're seeing the gradual here towards the end willingness of the candidate to sit down and talk to reporters.
Amazing
how that all happened.
I mean, she even talked to you and me this
week. Yeah, I was going to say. She talked to us on the same day.
She talked
to me before the event on Monday. She talked to you after the event on Monday.
You softened her up for me. I appreciate that.
And by the way, podcast listeners on iTunes, you're getting two podcasts this week. Not one, but two.
Wow.
One podcast that's just the entire conversation I had with Whitman, and then, of course, this lovely mash of stuff that we're
whatever the heck you call
doing.
This.
Yeah, so lucky you. Two podcasts in 1 week.
Wow.
Oh, the embarrassment of riches. But so she's starting to talk to more reporters. You know, my sense of and you tell me just really quickly and then we'll move on. But, you know, given that we haven't had a lot of sit-down time with her, my sense was she was very comfortable talking about all the issues. She you know, was willing to engage a little bit in some of the things that I talked about, trying to get her to explain in depth some of the policy proposals she has out there. And so I'm just not really sure what took so long to talk to the press. It doesn't seem like she
Why would you
can't hold her own talking to reporters.
Look, like most normal people, I think you figure, why talk to the press before you have to?
I guess, except is there any benefit in talking to the press now? I mean, that image is already out there for the people who care.
I don't know. I mean, I think the more you speak in unscripted situations, the more problem there is possibility there is to make a mistake. That if you can get away with not talking to the press for a while, it's fine. And then, you know, what happens is the press begins to sort of raise the speculation that maybe they're hiding something. Maybe the candidate can't hack it. You know, it really does lower expectations. So that when the candidate does talk to the press and they can string two sentences together, or not sometimes in the case of certain presidential candidates, then the bar is set so low already that the press says, okay, fine, you sort of pass a basic test. I mean, I don't know. I found a similar thing talking to her. I mean, she was very scripted and very disciplined in her messaging. I mean, I found it difficult to sort of knock her off her message, you know. But I think that just comes with seasoning, and so that's part of the benefit of waiting this long.
Yeah, probably so. The two things that I found out of the conversation I had with her just quickly that I kind of thought about afterwards. One was that no matter how many pieces of information I presented to her that don't quite jibe with the campaign's statements about what she'd do as governor, a lot of policy stuff, like where the 40,000 jobs have come from in the last 5 years in state government that have grown that she wants to cut, who's actually a welfare recipient, 78% of them are kids when she talks about putting more people to work, and on and on and on. They didn't deter her from her fundamental belief that we could still do it no matter what. You know, 78% are kids, that's fine, but we still need to have more of them work. Or more, not the kids.
Whoa.
Not the kids. Let me rephrase that. Not to have more of the kids work, but more of the parents work.
Please, sir, may I have some more?
Yeah, right. She's not advocating child labor. You know, so she still maintained her position and didn't see any change in it, even when presented with facts that don't quite jibe with the way the campaign has laid it out. And that's not that surprising.
Why let facts get in the way of a good campaign?
And the second one was a little more pointed description of why she's different from Arnold Schwarzenegger that I have heard before. As she said to me, she said, he was an actor. He was an investor. He had actually never really run businesses and done strategic thinking. And that's, you know, and I think that is the kind of you know, when people say, well, we've already had an outsider and it didn't work, I think that could have served her better earlier had she made that distinction.
She really
drawn out the distinction between Schwarzenegger earlier, because people in my real life say, we already had a person who didn't know anything about, you know, who came from the outside and it didn't work out.
Well, and I think that if she is the nominee, we'll probably hear more of that in the summer and the fall. And, I mean, she did weave that in. That jumped out at me as well when she weaved that into her stump speech, right, among her group of friends that she gathered there, except for the one questioner who thought she had a lame answer.
Yeah, this was in Roseville we're talking about, in the suburbs of Sacramento, where she took a question about being pro-choice and then actually
public
taxpayer funding of abortions, and tried to soft sell the fact that her fact that she's pro-choice to a person who's pro-life, and then the next questioner said that she gave a lame answer, and it was an awkward moment. But again, I thought she handled it okay, and that's part of
she gave an answer about education.
I think that's part of why you let the press see those things, and you do take those questions. But anyway,
okay.
So let's talk about speaking of the actor, ex-actor she wants to replace, and the budget that he put
forward.
That's our small segue into the budget here for a few minutes. Just sticking with the poll, and then that'll kind of let us roll back into what's happened with the budget, since a lot's happened with the budget since we last did a podcast. Governor's job approval ratings are a new low, 23%. I think even more interesting to me, 65% disapprove of Arnold Schwarzenegger's job as governor right now, which it just is what it is.
That's what it is.
And as a result, too, when you start talking about the budget, only 11% of the people surveyed say they like the governor's ideas for the budget above, say, members of the legislature, which is interesting considering how low the legislature's approval ratings are. 51% now say they would be willing to lower the threshold for passing a budget to a simple majority. That's just passing the budget. They still want to leave the tax hike at 2/3 vote in the legislature. What other good, fun budget ideas out of this?
There's taxes and spending cuts.
Yeah, there's some. As far as whether or not you'd raise taxes, 46 yes, 49 no. However, if you're going to raise taxes, 67% said let's do it on the wealthy. Only 28% said raise the car tax. Most of them said they'd raise taxes to protect K through 12 education. A lot of them, actually, 69%. And 54% even said for health and human services, which I think is interesting, too. And I think probably has to reflect the economy and what's going on. And this, you know, this notion that there are people hurting out there and maybe we've got to find a way to help them. Well, now, whether any of that influences the budget debate.
No. I mean, look, people are scared. You've talked about this before. I know this has been an issue for you, that the sort of schizophrenia of voters. I mean, I think this poll bears that out again.
Reinforces it one more time.
And yesterday, George Skelton wrote about that. As well.
Yes. So we've had a lot of budget action here at the Capitol.
Yes.
The governor's revised budget plan came out last Friday. We're just starting to see some of it trickle through the legislature. On Wednesday, a joint meeting of Assembly and Senate subcommittees on health and human services issues effectively told the governor no on his plan to eliminate CalWORKs and child care programs.
Shocking.
Shocking. I don't know. We've had the ledge analysts come out and say the governor's numbers seem reasonable about the size of the deficit, but they too said don't kill CalWORKs and child care. There are better ways to do this.
Right.
There are some fees that you should consider raising, some extra revenues, alcohol tax, right. Things like that.
Well, and look, this is the way – this I think strategically – the governor knows that the Democrats are not going to support an elimination of CalWORKs. He proposed it last year. It didn't happen. But what this does is this is a pass-the-buck budget proposal. It says, okay, look, you don't want this. This is my plan. You don't want to do this. You're either going to have to cut education or cut human services in order to pay for your funding of welfare. I mean, that's the governor's base approach to this budget, that, look, we're taking revenue increases off the table. And you guys, if you don't want this cut, then you got to find a cut to replace it with. I mean, that's
well, given that he has put that out there before, because, I mean, several people said that this week. Yeah, they've heard this thing about the governor eliminating CalWORKs. Of course, the difference was before it was always a worst case scenario in his budgets in the past. Like if we don't get federal money or if you don't do this, you don't do that. Now it was actually part of the actual plan A in his revised budget.
Right.
But if you look at this budget in a way. I'm going to use a poker analogy here for a moment.
Uh-oh. Does the phrase – oh, never mind.
It feels like a check raise.
Yeah.
Like if you've got two people playing poker – or not two people, but you've got multiple people playing and somebody – if you're not a poker person, just bear with me for a moment. And it's and the action is to you whether you raise the bet in the pot or not, and you do this thing you call a check, which basically
right.
– again, if you're not a poker player, this analogy sucks.
You don't bet.
Yeah. But you don't bet and you let somebody else make the bet first.
Right.
You pass the move to them. That's what this was to me. It was a check raise in the way you're saying it. Great. You don't want this? Let me see what your hand is.
Well,
let me
check,
see what your bet is.
The check raise is actually when you check earlier – and then it comes back to you and you
raise. Of course, you could argue you checked earlier, too,
right.
in January,
right.
but still.
Yes.
But so, no, I mean, right. The question is, how do you get there then? The ledge analyst put out a few things that were interesting to me. And the
I think football analogy works, too. Punt? No? This was a punt?
It could have been a punt.
Okay.
It's a punt on third down.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Moving
now
on.
That we've mixed ourselves completely here.
Sorry.
Talking about when you look at some of the recommendations the ledge analyst put out, I mean, one of the most contentious issues is going to be education. There's no way to get around the public schools debate. It's the largest part of the general fund. And the ledge analyst's position was suspend Prop 98. It's part of the constitutional guarantee. You can suspend and just say we're going to give the schools whatever money we have and whatever exists between what you gave them. And what they would have gotten is now an established maintenance factor, quote unquote, that you have established rules on how the schools get it paid back over time. And that the ledge analyst position is that is a cleaner, more reasonable way to lower school funding than to jigger everything with smoke and mirrors and say you're actually maintaining funding when you're not.
Right.
But suspending Prop 98 is a political issue.
And we saw that this week.
It's almost never happened. Exactly.
Well,
we saw that.
Your neighbors at the California Teachers Association here sent me a nice piece of mail this week.
I got it yesterday. And they put a billboard up in Sacramento.
Right.
Attacking the pro tem of the Senate, Daryl Steinberg, saying protect our schools.
Right. No. And I guess, do we both live in Steinberg's Assembly District or Senate District?
I do. I got it at home.
I do as well. So
that was an opening salvo, though.
Yeah, clearly. And so, but it sort of highlights where we are in this debate, right? Where Democrats are going to be in a position yet again where they're going to have, where their allies are essentially competing against each other. And this is all in the backdrop of the election where you have a number of competitive races, both in the Senate and the Assembly in the fall. And so we'll see how all this plays out.
It's interesting, too. I think if you look at the California Teachers Association, and he called them our neighbor because their building's right next door to the studio that you're hearing this lovely podcast from. But if you look at the CTA, they're the ones pushing this ballot measure in November to repeal these business tax credits.
Yes.
This seems like a very nice folding in of their message politically and budget-wise. Again,
right.
Pushing back on why are we giving corporations, big businesses, you know, billion-dollar tax credits when we're cutting schools and other programs. And, you know, so one way or the other, it seems like it works for their message.
Yep.
If they don't get it in the legislature as part of the budget process, it strengthens their hand for November to get the voters to approve it.
Yep.
Yep, that's all you got.
That's my hard-hitting analysis.
That's your big analysis there?
Agreed. I concur. Yes, sir. You are correct.
Are you also one of these people, too, who thinks that this budget season's going to go really long? You keep hearing people not even really half-joking about going into October because there's just the answers are so elusive.
It feels that way. And also you see the governor now sort of trying to frame the debate and really expand the debate. You have Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg, talking about wanting budget reform as part of this budget deal. And the governor repeatedly has talked about wanting pension reform.
And budget reform.
And budget and tax reform as part of this deal, too. And remember, this is Schwarzenegger's last chance. This is his final budget. And so
is this kind of a quest of his to remain relevant?
And I think they're very cognizant of their legacy in the Schwarzenegger political shop and the policy shop as well. And so I think that those dynamics could indeed make for a prolonged budget. And it's interesting. I mean, the longer this goes on, you know, we have a number of measures on the November ballot. Potentially, number one, the rollback of taxes that you talked about. Number two, you've got the majority vote budget. You know, I mean, what better case to make for a majority vote, the need for a majority vote
You've
budget?
You've also got the fees measure that the business community put on, that
right.
any fee increases should be a two-thirds vote, like
right.
taxes.
We assume all these are going to qualify. They've all submitted their signatures. We'll find out in the next couple of weeks. You know, it's going to be an awkward summer. What can I say?
Yeah, and you know, and the governor flat out said he wouldn't sign a budget without budget reform or pension reform. I mean, that
yes.
was his line in the sand.
He
at his,
did say
at his press
that.
Conference
that is correct.
Last Friday. Now, we'll, you know,
right.
we'll see where that goes. But
right.
that certainly, I mean, my initial reaction was budget reform, okay. Because as you said, the Democrats are talking about budget reform. They're talking about different kinds of budget reform.
Clearly.
The governor's talking about spending caps and rainy day funds effectively.
The Democrats are talking about
what's called realignment, changing the relationship between local and state government, the financing and the expenses. Those are different things, but they all are quote unquote budget reform. So you could see some way that, you know, maybe we could find something there.
Maybe.
Pension reform, I think, is a lot harder. Pension
yes.
reform seems much more, I don't want to say totally black and white, but pension reform is kind of hard to kind of fudge that way. I mean, either you are really going to fundamentally change the structure, you know, define contributions, define benefits for current and future employees, or you're not.
Yep.
So that's a harder one, and that also pits the governor against the legislature, against the Democrats' core constituency sometimes of organized labor. I mean,
right.
that's a harder one to crack, it seems like.
Yep. And at a time when Democrats are making decisions to cut. To make funding decisions that adversely affect their friends in organized labor, I think holding their ground on the pension issue is a way for them to sort of earn some chits back. So
yeah,
and I wouldn't count on it.
And I was just going to say the only other thing too is look at the different groups who depend on the budget and just try to imagine what kind of fight we're going to have here. Higher education, which actually came out pretty good in the governor's revised budget because the governor says he would keep all the, you know, he continues to promise the extra money that he promised them earlier in the year.
Right.
Higher education, K-12 schools, social services, CalWORKs, childcare, you know, and I'm sure I'm leaving out people. State workers who he wants to give a day of personal leave a month.
In addition to their pay cut and pension.
Which actually the two together would almost equal a pay cut equal to what the furlough pay cut has been. But yet an increased contribution for their pensions.
Right.
These are all, I mean, you know, pitting these against each other in a way is a really ugly drama that's going to play out.
It's been playing out over the last couple of years.
Sure, but we've had a lot of smoke and mirrors. We've figured out lots of things that have made people unhappy, but they haven't going to, I would argue, they haven't made them unhappy to the level they will be unhappy in this one.
Right.
Would you think that's fair?
Yes. Every year, a little unhappier.
A little unhappier.
Yeah.
You just agree with everything I say today. You like that, huh? Come on.
No, that's not true.
You're supposed to take it all to issue.
That's not true.
Okay. So.
I disagree.
What did we not talk about in this podcast?
Whatever it was your fault.
Oh, really? That's it. And also, I'll give a plug to Anthony. He has a piece in Capital Weekly this week, capitalweekly.net.
Capital with an O.
Yes. Looking at a races to watch in the legislature, state assembly, state senate races that are either hot or they tell a larger story, or because larger story is the one I'm thinking in the state senate you talked about.
Or people have funny names that are running in those, you know, whatever criteria we had.
But it's a good read. It's a good read if you care about the legislature and you're interested. And I think, too, just last thing on this, if you're interested in those dynamics, because those dynamics either reflect what's going on here with the budget or vice versa, the budget debate reflects into those races, right? I mean,
yes.
One of the two.
Yes.
They tell you what truth.
I mean, No, I'm supposed to disagree, right?
No, but like your state senate one that you picked, right?
Oh, yeah. The
Talk about that one just for a moment.
The Democratic primary?
Yeah, talk about it.
Mary Salas, Assemblywoman Mary Salas, running against former Assemblyman Juan Vargas.
And this is a district down
in
south.
San Diego to replace Denise Ducheney, the chair of the Budget Committee. Vargas has received more than $1 million already from business groups who are backing him through independent expenditures. Steinberg is supporting...
That's the pro tem.
That we talked about earlier.
Yes,
that's
sorry.
Why I just used his last name.
Sorry.
Standard style.
Sorry.
Myers. Is supporting Mary Salas and is urging Senate staffers to focus on that race in their quote-unquote free time, right? Using vacation time to campaign. I think it's a test for Steinberg. And also... it'll be a test for the clout of moderates. I mean, it's kind of interesting for all this talk about open primaries and doing away with this redistricting plan that has polarized the legislature. We see the Senate leader now working hard to make sure that a moderate Democrat does not get elected. So watch that one. That'll be fun.
Yeah. That's probably the one to watch out of the upper house right now, huh?
On the Democratic side, the Keene LaMalfa on the Senate side, or on the Republican side.
Two former Republican assembly members.
Yes, up in Northern California, Chico area. There was one more.
They're all in the article.
Yeah. I forget. I wrote it, and it's gone.
CapitalWeekly.net.
Yes.
He's cleared his mind. He's moving on. And we'll move on. So with that, I'm John Myers from KQED. How's that segue?
Good.
It's Anthony York from Capital Weekly. We'll see you next time.